am I interrupting someone?
Okay.
I found this stuff on my desk last week. And why don't you, I guess the university requires it, or maybe you students lobbied for it and got them. Oh, really?
Yeah, you should give them to us at 5 o'clock.
Oh, really?
5:30 or...
Could you...
We have to turn it in.
Oh, okay. Why don't we do that? Towards the end of the class, but I don't want to cut into Emil's time today, though.
Yeah, we don't really...
How long will it take to do these?
Well, we could do it now, and you could leave and come and run it upstairs, and then...
Okay. Okay.
You want to leave?
Could you do that? Okay, good. That way I can talk to the computer will kick it out. You, no, here's the instructions. Here. Okay, I'll see you down in about, 15 minutes?
Yeah.
Okay, 10 minutes. Okay, I'll be back. Didn't know you all were through. God, this class has grown. Where did everybody come from? We better pass out another form, huh?
Came back
from spring break, I guess. All right, we got a couple extra visitors here or something. Anybody got a sheet of paper they want to pass around? By the end of the class, I've got 4 or 5 questions I'm going to put on the wall, sort of in preparation for our test, right, on the 4th. I'll have another 4 or 5 next week. I'll give you a couple of weeks to look at the first 4 or 5, and then another week to look at the ones I come up with next week. And so don't rush off until you get them off the wall, okay? After Emil gets through speaking. The last time I asked you if there's anything else we needed to cover or anybody we needed to invite, you suggested Emil Nadi. Well, since your wish is my command, I twisted his arm and forced him to get on an airplane this morning. Actually, I haven't maybe known Emil as long as some of you. He's comes from the interior, and it so happens that when I first got involved in politics back in 1966, as I left the campus, well, before I left the campus, actually, one of the people I met in Anchorage was Emil Nadi, who was at that time president of the Cook Inlet Native Association. And as you recall, his organization was the first host for the initial gathering, which eventually became the Alaska Federation of Natives. And Emil performed the role of an initiator in a way that I'm sure none of us could have done. He was living in a city and had lived in cities, quite unlike a lot of the people who eventually became involved in the politics of the Settlement Act. And he wasn't as cowed by the system as some of us were, I think. And he had to make some judgments right off the bat when we were trying to form AFN that were real critical, because there was a question as to whether or not we could maintain control of our own institution that we were trying to create, or whether or not we were simply going to be little puppets for some other people who thought perhaps we were not prepared to lead our own organization. So with that, I'll let Emil describe more of himself and his perceptions and anything about the the Settlement Act that he would like to talk about, or the AFN in its formation. I gave him about five or six questions that of the type that I thought you might be interested in hearing about. And I would like to introduce the founder of the AFN, Emil Nadi.
I already warned him that I would be doing a little sideshow, occasionally interrupting him, trying to remind him of some things that may not have gone exactly like he said they did.
Here are Willie's questions, so I'll use them as an outline. I've had a heck of a time trying to get up here on a Monday. Seems like I've always been down in Juneau or somewhere else, and finally this weekend it worked out to where I could be here. Willie's first thing, it says something about my background. Well, it's true, I was living in the city, and when we formed AFN, I was born in Keokuk. Okay. I left the Yukon village when I was about 11, is that better? About 11 years old, and went to Mount Edgecombe, or Eklutna before Mount Edgecombe. And after that, I was in the Navy, and spent 5 years after the Navy getting a degree in electronics as an engineer, and decided to get out of engineering and go into management. And I got back to Alaska. We formed the early organizations around social issues. Used to see pictures in the newspaper and say a fisherman and native guide, you know, and they'd say Joe the Oaks from Iowa's fishing was the native guide. Native people didn't have names. So those are the kinds of things we would try to make people more aware and get the newspapers to start naming native people. They were people. We formed because there was a real big push on for education. FNA, the reason FNA formed was mainly because of education. Cook Inlet Native Association formed shortly after that around the issue of jobs and housing and health statistics. You know, after 100 years of existence, Native people were still have the worst housing conditions, the worst health statistics, and the worst achievement in education. So something was wrong and something wasn't happening. So we formed these organizations. And Cook Inlet Native Association was one of the groups that we funded people to go around the state and try to organize different groups, mainly on social issues. And then if you look at a map of Alaska, you'll see where all the state land is. Back a few years ago, it was all along the highways. Everywhere there was a highway, the state took land, and they were turning land into money because the state had no money. They had no economic base, and that's how they were funding state government, was by selling land. And it became an issue when down in Tolk Junction, surveyors went through there and they drove stakes right through the graveyard, and they went down to New York and started selling wilderness sites, disregarding totally native use and occupancy of the land. Well, there weren't any of us that knew anything about land rights. And we were all kind of stumbling around, and we're all talking land rights. And Governor Egan had a few meetings with Ralph Perdue from FNA. But the thing that kind of pulled it together in my thinking as a background paper and put things into focus was a paper written by a student here at the university who was a graduate student at the time. And it was called, he's taking constitutional law from Rabinowitz, who is now Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. And the paper was entitled, What Rights and Land Do Alaska Natives Have? And he cited a number of laws going back through the years. And that was the first time that I had an understanding of what rights we might have in land. And that paper was written by some young student called Willie Hensley. And so we used to push Willie out front. They had a Federal Land Law Review Committee that came through Alaska, and Willie was even though he was a student, he was hot property, because we used to push him as a front man, probably because he was more articulate and maybe a little bit smarter than the rest of us. You know, when I talk about health issues, do you know that as far as I know, the Alaska Native people went through the worst tuberculosis epidemic ever recorded anywhere in the world? That in the late 1800s, a Catholic priest estimated that there were about 80,000 Native people in Alaska. And in 1940, I think the census in Alaska, there were 72,000 people. And the 50-50 crossover point was estimated at in 1939. So roughly half of the 72,000 people were Alaska Natives, say 36,000 people. So more than half of the Native population died off mainly from tuberculosis. And nobody really did anything about it until the early 50s when they started building the sanitariums. And I read a paper one time, or a newspaper article, assistant surgeon general came through Alaska around the turn of the century, and he went back to Congress and testified, and he said to Congress, the indigenous population is in danger of becoming extinct. He didn't expect them to last another generation. And therefore, it was incumbent upon Congress to do something to protect the miners from this infection. So nobody was really concerned with the epidemic that did go through the country. And it left the Native people, the survivors, many of them were crippled. And you see people who are 50 years old today, many of them have one lung or have bone problems or, you know, whatever. So the survivors were not in that good of health. So those were the kinds of things that initially got the organizations going. The thing that got us off on AFN was 1966. There was an area director for BIA named Bob Bennett, and they tapped him to become commissioner of BIA in Washington, D.C. So in January, he was going through his Senate confirmation hearings, and he was an Oneida Indian. And they said, Mr. Bennett, you're an Indian. What do you propose to do different that will break this cycle of bad health and education and housing and high unemployment? And he didn't have a ready answer. So Senator Jackson said, come back in 90 days with a written report of your program. So in April, Bob Bennett went back to the United States Senate with a written report, and in that report he devoted about a half a page to Alaska. And in it he said the Bureau of Indian Affairs was drawing up a final solution to the land problem in Alaska. I was president of Cook Inlet Native Association at the time, and I read that and I thought about it and I sat on it, and finally in July I wrote some letters to some people around the state saying, if the BIA was going to draw up a solution to the problem, if we have any rights in that land, we ought to have something to say about what that solution is. So I suggested a meeting in October. Howard Roth got a hold of my copy of that letter, and he pushed that meeting real hard. And I wrote letters to about 14 people. Many of them I didn't know. Jerome Trigg from Nome, and Tony Lewis from Bethel, and Hugh Nichols from Barrow, and Soboloff from Southeastern. And I figured we'd have 14 people sit down and talk about what we might do. But with Howard Rocks headlining the meeting and stressing the importance of it and pushing it, and the money put into it by the Taiwanese Indians, who had recently got some $11, $12, $14 million from some oil leases over in Tyonic. When I called the meeting to order, in October of 1966, we had about 300 people. And at that point, we decided to form AFN. During that meeting, we had a number of committees, but one of the committees we sent out to study a problem was a land committee. And that committee worked up a report and came back two or three days later and reported to the body, and we adopted the position paper of that body, and they had some help of an attorney in Washington, D.C. named Marvin Sanowski. But that the chairman of that committee was, again, a young guy named Willie Hensley. So he kind of played a key role through a lot of this. That bill, that position paper, we adopted in October of 66. In April of 1967, we'd sent these out with cover letters to a congressman, and nothing happened. In April of 67, I wired Senator Bartlett, Senator Greening, and Representative Howard Pollack, asked them to introduce our position paper into Congress as a bill. Senator Bartlett wired right back within a couple of days that he had introduced our bill in the Senate side, and it became the first land claims bill to the Senate Bill 2020. That bill, if it had gone anywhere, would have given us the right to claim all of Alaska. What it was, normally if you go through the courts can only award you damage. Somebody wrecks your car, they pay you for the car. Somebody breaks your arm, they pay you for your pain and suffering. But they can't pay you for anything that you haven't lost. Well, we said we hadn't lost all of Alaska yet, so if we could prove use on the land, they empowered the court to give us title to that land, not as damages, but just give us title to that land. That bill got shifted into the Judiciary Committee, where it immediately died. But if that bill had gone anywhere, we probably would own 95% of Alaska right now. What came out after, I think there were 8 bills finally introduced. Everybody got into the act. The Interior Department had a bill, and State of Alaska had a bill, and AFN had developed a bill after 3 or 4 years of tough sessions. And the administration, being the White House, they had a bill different from the Interior Department. So everybody had something to say about the Land Claims Act. And they talk about a negotiated settlement. It really wasn't negotiated. After we testified for a number of years, they went behind closed doors and decided on some real key issues. We just didn't have the political muscle, for instance, to carry. One of our positions was 2% of whatever was in the ground forever. If, in fact, we owned the land, like anybody who owns land, you can make any kind of a deal in the land that you want. And our position was, if there was any wealth in the land, we should participate. If there's no wealth in it, we wouldn't participate. So we wanted 2% in perpetuity. Congress wasn't going to buy that. It says open-ended, and there was no limit on the payments and whatnot. So the result was they gave $500 million from 2% royalties, which the state of Alaska just paid off last summer. So you can see it was a tremendous amount, or an issue that we lost just because we couldn't hold it. Then they went, that was one of the things, they went behind closed doors and just kind of handed us the bill and said, this is what you get. Yes?
Who is they?
Senate Interior Committee.
Do you think that they were under pressure, members of the committee were under pressure from outside interests, or was it strictly a deal cut?
We were always kind of paranoid about outside pressure. As a matter of fact, we used to watch all the time to see what the oil lobbyists were doing. They were the main ones that we knew they had a lot of power and and could move things. But as far as I know, their position was they didn't care how to solve the problem. I don't know of any outside pressure that dealt strictly on the 2%. I think that was just Congress's method of operation. There were outside pressures on, mainly from conservation groups, where they set aside this 80 million acres that ballooned to 100 million acres for wild and scenic rivers and more forest land and, you know, those reserves. But I don't think there was outside pressure on the 2%, except maybe the White House.
Well, remember, we always knew that Congress did maintain money, but we knew that they never wanted to convey land. That was a historical push, and as you'll recall, Secretary Udall was the first to propose the method of payment using funds from outer continental shelf revenues, or leases that might have been bid out, say, in the Gulf of Alaska or other places.
Right. He proposed 2% from offshore for us because they didn't want to. They didn't want to appropriate money, but if it was going to come from resources, they could just take it on, pass it on to us. But there were a lot of ridiculous. Go ahead. Sorry.
Well, we had choices at the time when they handed you that bill. You said you felt like you could have that line. What were your
choices? We could try to kill it or accept it.
How would you try to kill
it? We just go to our friends and say vote against it. And there were a lot of people who were sympathetic that would have done it for us. I don't know if we would have had the votes to kill it or not, but that was our option.
Did you take that option
to
try and kill it?
No, we didn't. We hit a very small window of time, I think. There were a lot of proposals, but some of them were very small. Udall's proposal was $180 million to buy Alaska from us. When he proposed that, I sent him a...
That was the second one.
Second one, right.
The first proposal was wanted to have the Attorney General go to the court on our behalf, and they set the date of taking as of 1867, which made it $7.2 million.
Yeah, there were some really ridiculous numbers. And when he said the $180 million, I sent him a telegram and said, if the United States government thinks Alaska is worth only $180 million, we'd guarantee payment if the United States government would move out of Alaska, because it was not worthwhile to consider. So, if I start to say, I think we hit a very small window of time. 5 years earlier, we couldn't have gotten any money. Congress would not have given us any money. 5 years earlier, they could have bought Alaska, I'm sure, for $50 million, and you know, we just weren't prepared for it. 5 years later, as you all know, Alaska land was so valuable that they would never have given us 40 million acres of land. If we had to do it again, I don't think we could get 10 million acres of land today, because land is so valuable. So I think it's we just were very fortunate in hitting and being organized and pushing for that. We were riding things that were happening in the United States. One was rioting on campus. Yeah, right. Watts was burning down, $40 million of damage in Watts. Students were shot down in Kent State. I was down in D.C. in November of 69, and 500,000 people marched in protest of the Vietnam War. As strange as it sounds, SST debates were very big debates at that time, because they were afraid of the atmospheric effects of it. And in a lot of ways, the Land Claims Act, I think, is a social experiment. Now, that's just my judgment. That's nobody's opinion but my own. And I view it as an experiment in this way. After the Army failed in controlling Indians, they formed the Bureau of Indian Affairs to control the affairs of Indian people. 100 years later, Indian people still had all of the problems that they had in the beginning. that I just mentioned, education, housing, employment, and health, mainly. So nothing was working. They were looking for a new method of dealing with the Indian problems. And the people who were dealing with the land years, Jackson in the Senate and Aspinall in the House. And between them, they wrote much of the Indian legislation. They wrote the termination of the Menominee in Minnesota. They wrote the termination of the Klamath Indians in eastern Washington. Both of those experiments failed. They went through the era of Eisenhower when they tried to relocate Indians off of the reservations. Bureau of Indian Affairs was coming back every year and wanting more than $100 million to solve these problems, and nothing was happening. So when I say it's an experiment, here we came down here saying we didn't want trust lands for the BIA to run. We wanted to run the land ourselves. We'd make the decisions. And so in some ways it's an attempt to assimilate the Indians into the economic system in the shortest time possible by making businessmen out of them. Everybody is now aware of what a stock is and what a stockholder is and what a proxy is and how you run corporations. And and they made sure of one other thing, that there were no, in their words, in Jackson's words, there were no native enclaves. No area set aside exclusively for native occupancy. And they did that with every village is required to give to the municipal government 1,280 acres of land. Well, a lot of the villages are setting on 200 acres of land. So 1,280 acres is an awful lot of land for expansion. And most of that expansion is going to come from outsiders moving in. And when they move in, they become part of the city council, and the city council and can get the 1,280 acres from the native village corporations. And so you've got, wherever there's a native village, there's going to be a non-native community. And so there will, on the present sites anyway, there will be no native communities exclusively. And you can see them shifting right now. During this period of time, March of 1969, I was going to Seattle to make a speech to the Northwest Confederated or Federated Tribes, and the reason is we were going back right into Jackson's home country, Senator Jackson, from Washington State, and I wanted them to know that we were fooling around with his constituents, that he'd feel some pressure from us being there, and went down to Pacific Lutheran University. And they said they would have about 800 people there. Well, I don't think they had 800 people, but we had a good crowd. And I was trying to decide, gee, what am I going to tell them? I can't just go down there and tell them that we've testified to Congress for 4 years and we've had so many bills introduced and we're going back there next year and we've got some more hearings coming up and please write letters to help us. What I said was, the United States fighting a war in Vietnam because we're concerned about human rights and justice for people and despotic governments. And we're sending our young people all over the world as a police force. They were avoiding the word war. It wasn't the war. It was a police action, just to protect people's rights. And I said we've also spent billions of dollars to reestablish the country of Israel. Without United States money, Israel wouldn't exist today. And we backed them against hostile governments and their enemies. So without our active support and our airplanes and our arms, Israel wouldn't exist today. So I said the United States government, with their world conscience and all, can do no less for a people right here in the North American continent who lost all of their homeland. So therefore, if Congress couldn't give us what we considered an adequate land base, namely 40 million acres, that I would propose to the board of directors of AFN that we go to the World Court and United Nations and petition for a separate country in Alaska. Not another state, a separate country. We would have our own sovereignty. And that seemed to strike something. What I was looking for was we were getting pushed off of it. We'd go back to Washington, D.C. and get all set for a hearing and at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and afternoon they'd say, your hearing is tomorrow. We got debates over here on something else. We just weren't getting the attention. And I wanted somebody down in Arkansas to pick up the newspaper and say, my God, what are you talking about? It's a separate country in Alaska before. You know, why is it important? So I got news clippings from Arkansas and Missouri and from around the country where I don't know how people knew where to send them, but I was getting them in the mail. So I like to think it was... what I want to do is make them know we were serious, that we weren't just going to accept 10 million acres of land, which is one of the proposals, and $100 million. And it was kind of like ice cubes in a glass. You know, you push a cube down here and it pops up some, another one pops up over here. And that's just what kind of a trade-off we were in. We were on a trade-off of land and money. If we wanted more money, they'd give us less land. If we wanted more land, they'd give us less money. So we were trying to strike a balance of land and money. Corporations now, you see a lot of headlines that corporations are losing money, and some of them are in real trouble. A lot of them, I think, are doing fairly well. But I think, for the most part, there's a real good chance that the corporations are going to do well. You know, people who sell newspapers like to see a lot of people in town. You can't sell newspapers in Galena because there are only 300 people there. You can't make a living. You have to have tens of thousands of people to sell newspapers in order to have a big plant and do a lot of advertising. The more people you have, the more money you make. So you see Chamber of Commerce is all over the state saying we need growth, we need economic development. And Chamber of Commerce people are business people. And of course they always want to see more money because they sell more shoes and sell more light bulbs, and they're in a selling business mainly. So you contrast that with the villagers who aren't in the business of selling anything, and they say, we don't want any growth and we don't want any roads and we don't want that economic development too close to us because it upsets our hunting and our way of life. So there's a conflict there. But growth is going to come. When you look at the statistics, by the year 2000, everybody says America's going to have 300 million people. We have 220 million people right now. That's the next 20 years, another 80 million people. And every one of them is going to have to, well, families. They're going to need a home and schools and police departments and fire departments and roads and airports to take care of those people and jobs. And 80 million people doesn't sound too much. It's 8 cities the size of Los Angeles. In the next 20 years, it's 2.5 cities the size of Seattle every year. And when you look at Detroit shutting down, the United States government bailing Lockheed out, and a lot of people out of work, and high unemployment, and they read in the newspaper, like I read Sunday, an oil rigger up here is making $90,000 a year. They're going to come here because there's opportunity. We have all the resources. We have energy, we have timber, we have land, we have good air, clean water. Opportunity. People are going to gravitate to opportunity. Already we have a little pocket down here in Kenai. It was probably one of the fastest growing areas in America last year. So Alaska is going to see more growth. I think we're going to see more change in the next 10 years than we've seen in the past 30 years, just because of expansion and job opportunities. Now, while we may not want all of that growth. It still represents opportunity for village corporations and native corporations, and they've got to capitalize on that growth in their businesses. And with a profit motive, they're going to have to capitalize and position themselves to do that. And so I think the future, is, from a business point of view, is very good for the corporations to do well. And how they translate that money into lifestyle for their shareholders, I don't know. That's something that you're going to have to decide, because it's going to be in your hands in the next 5 years and 10 years. Any questions that you want to ask? I kind of followed Willie's outline.
Can you maybe talk about some of the problems you had in trying to hold this together? I remember you and some of the others helped me and Lori after our initial organization in October of 66. You guys had to coup d'etat, eliminated some of those hardworking slaves. I mean, you know, there was always a problem of trying to hold everybody together and then we might tell why and how we handle it.
Let's see. Yeah.
About, you were talking about the village sites having, what was it, 1,080, what was it?
1,280 acres.
1,280 acres on each village site, so they can grow that much?
That they have to give to the city governments.
Yeah, explain that a little more, could you? What that's all
about? Out of the village lands, right around the village, they're required to give up to 1,280 acres of land to the city government. And the city government is a you know, just government. You know, they can't discriminate. If it's corporation land, they could parcel it out to shareholders. But it's not, once it goes to city government, it's in the public. So they'll sell it to whoever wants to build on it. And therefore, that land is going to be used only by people who need to build a home, which would be mainly new people moving into the village. So therefore, the native villages as we know them, I think, are something that in time will disappear.
Each village is considered a city then?
They're required, they're all second-class cities now. They're required by state law, right, Willie, to incorporate as second-class cities here and in over there.
Do they have to sell their 1,200 acre? I mean, can't, as a city, they put a cap on selling any of the land? Because wouldn't most of them have adequate land for new native homes on the village site and then just not lease the land as a city government or something like that? There should be some method.
Well, I think there'll be efforts to slow it down. But once the balance shifts in the village, it only takes about 20% non-native residents in a village, that's just a figure off the top of my head, something less than half anyway, for the power to shift, because mainly the village people don't want to get involved with being on the city council and school board. So just by experience, if you look around at villages that you're familiar with, once they get a non-native population in there, the city government, the power shifts to the non-native, and they will be in control of the 1,280 acres. I'm sure there are ways to slow down the sale. Yeah. Yeah. Jim?
Well, I thought the new D2 bill enables the village to negotiate with the municipality to reduce the acreage.
Yeah. Up to 1,280. Yeah.
My question was, though, you mentioned that, well, you yourself belong to Lexington Brotherhood, AFN, Joint Board of Directors, school boards, and all kinds of things. You've been on a lot of committees at once. Do you feel like sometimes it gets too much?
Used to be. I'm not on any of those now. You know, I've kind of come full circle. I work by myself with a telephone. I don't have a board of directors, and I'm not on any board of directors, and I don't not on any councils or school boards or anything like that. So there is a problem when you're starting out and getting active of when to quit. And something I learned the hard way was I was spreading myself too thin. And so, I just made a decision that I wasn't going to get on any school boards or not on the Doran board of directors, and I'm not involved in anything, just taking care of myself. Kind of fun. No, that came about the time I made the decision not to get involved in it. And I don't live in one of the districts anyway, so I used to fight with SOS once in a while, that's about all. Do you have a question?
Do you think the villages could somehow, it seems like basically the money's going to come to, they're going to have to get the kids that are in school today to get into the council, to get into all the different organizations, school board, to get into the leadership of the villages. And, you know, it seems like that's going to really have to be a push over the next 5 or 10 years to maintain a village lifestyle. Have any ideas on how that can be done? Or?
Well, I think a lot of it's happening. You find a lot of concern, and one of the things that's going to help is the high schools. I've seen villages start to die off. One of the most dramatic ones, way back in the, it began in the 50s, when Hoonah was a big village and started to die off because the kids were going to Mount Edgecombe and not going back. And then they got a high school, and there was a resurgence in the village. A lot of people moved back because they wanted their kids to get an education. There was a chance there to live in a village and get an education. And you see some of that in Galena. I'm familiar with Galena, so I'm sure it's happening in other places. That once they got their high school, the whole community kind of shifted. Parents would travel all over the state to watch their kids play basketball. They had a track team that traveled around. Parents started keeping their kids home. So there was kind of regaining the spirit and getting some active participation. And I think that's going to, in time, be one of the very key decisions that's going to help the villages. Yes.
Do you think self-determination helps villages today in Alaska?
Well, yeah, I suppose we weren't really touched by self-determination like it affected the reservation type people where all the decisions were being made by BIA people. We've always kind of had self-determination here. All it did was strengthen us with dealing with people like Tendo Chiefs who were supposed to be advocates and are advocates for self-determination. But that law was aimed mainly at reservation type situations where BIA has a stranglehold on who leases your land. They make the decisions of who leases your land. You know, a lot of cattle grazers getting land at 2 bits an acre a year, made not by the tribe but by BIA people. I'm sure it helps with funding and other things. I'm not too familiar with how all the ways it does help, but it helps in some ways, but it affected us less up here than it did in the South 48. They wouldn't send them to school there unless there was a high school there. So the state program for four building high schools, and then the Molly Hooch case, I think, was the one that really was the one that helped. Yes.
Have these corporations lived up to your expectations?
No.
What did you expect from them?
Well, I expected a little more diligence in their investments. And what happened with some of them is they took some bad advice and made some bad investments. Of course, you know, everybody was, like I said, was in some ways a social experiment. Part of that experiment was that they made a lot of mistakes. Some people made a lot of mistakes. Everybody felt that they had to do something, you know. And so a lot of villages and regional corporations rushed in to do something. They didn't know exactly what they were going to do, but they made investments, construction companies, hotels, all kinds of businesses. A lot of the businesses failed, and that's sort of the mistake. Some of the best decisions made was to do nothing. Because, especially by a village corporation, a small village corporation getting money, if they did nothing every year, that money built up to where they could get enough money to run an office. In the early days, if they open an office and start paying people and telephones and office space and heat and travel and insurance and all these things, every year the money came from land claims and it was spent. 10 years later, they've spent all the money. They have nothing. The ones that by the ones that rushed into them.
What do you think should be done with the land, the transfer or whatever? What do you think?
Which land?
The land that, like, say, Doyon has got. I mean, they haven't done anything with it so far. It's been conveyed, out there, they've done a little bit of exploration. Do you think it should go to the people slowly for sale to the Japanese, or
well, you know, it's a corporate asset. They can't do anything with it without two-thirds vote of the shareholders. They can't distribute corporation assets without two-thirds consent of the owners. And to get two-thirds vote out of shareholders is going to be very hard to do. The Doyon started out with 50%. Or 51% shareholders represented in person or by proxy at an annual meeting. It's a very tough time in getting 50%. People just don't send their proxies back. The Aleut League has postponed meetings as many as three times to hold one annual meeting. And every time they call a meeting, it costs them $20,000. Preparation and travel, and a lot of people come in, can't get a quorum. So they postpone it. And then, in a big effort, they go and they fly charter airplanes and they fly into every village and pick up proxies. And it gets very expensive. My point to that story is it's going to be very difficult to get a two-thirds vote to dispose of the assets of the land. I think it, you know, one of the things is there's a lot of land. They could probably give everybody 10 acres if they wanted it, every shareholder, and still not be hurt. Maybe there should be a distribution of part of it and keep the economic lands. One of the problems with development in Doyon land was we know there's an unexplored oil basin out by Fort Yukon. Nobody knows what's there. And because nobody knows, it has value. They explored up on the Kandik and they killed the basin. They sunk a couple of dry holes and nobody's interested in them. Doesn't mean there's nothing there. There's still maybe, I don't know, Atlantic Richfield had 11 holes before they found crude oil, I think is what it was. So the Yukon Flats is still open. One of the reasons that nothing has been done with it was you've got some wild and scenic rivers up there, you've got wildlife refuges, and until D2 passed, nobody knew where those boundaries were. So no oil company was going to come in and give you $1 million to go in there and start drilling. And a year later, they pass D2 and they find out that they're surrounded by a wild and scenic river, and you can't get across, can't get your oil out. So now that the land patterns are set and the maps are defined, they know how they can get out. And so the fear of not being able to get out is not as great, and I expect that they'll start doing something with it. I expect there'll be a lot of development. Most regions now are looking at their land for economic purposes. Chew Gas region can select land down in the Prince William Sound area, in the forest area, strictly for economic purposes, and their forestry is required to give them a road access to any minerals they find, and it's a highly mineralized area. So I think that they're looking now, you're going to see more activity. Yeah, for minerals and whatnot.
How do you feel
the best way to go about exploration? Well, a lot of exploration has been going on already and don't even know about it. We used to play a little game with BLM. I guess I can tell this, I will. They withdrew, government withdrew three times as much land as we were entitled to. And they didn't know how much we were entitled to because it depended upon a roll. 11 years later, as far as I know, there's still not a final roll. Is there really? The numbers are still shifting of what a final roll is. And so they divide the land up on a per capita basis. And until that roll is finalized, they can't tell you how much land you're going to get. So we used to say, they used to tell us, select your land and drop the other two-thirds of it. We'd say, well, tell us how much land we're entitled to and we'll select it. But the reason we were delaying was we had helicopter crews out there every summer doing what we called the stupid approach. They'd run along and dip water out of all the streams and label them, and all winter long they'd analyze these waters, and when they find asbestos or uranium or, you know, whatever, lead, in the samples of water, they would go back and they'd find that spot, and then they'd follow where the river split, and they'd take, you know, two samples, and they kept narrowing these things down. Now we've had all these years to do that, and so we know pretty well where the minerals are. We've isolated them. In the past few years, we've been out there with drilling cores and rock samples. Just, it was a progression of water sampling and getting out on the land, following the water, with picking up rocks, and then analyzing the rocks in the winter, and then going back with drills and analyzing what was under the ground. And so by now, we have a pretty good idea where the minerals are. So the exploration has been going on. And what you'll see now is more intensive drilling to determine. It's like the asbestos area. We've been in there now up around Eagle for 10 years. And there was outcroppings of asbestos. ASARCO was in there 20 years ago, and they walked away from it. Some of the best asbestos in the world. Long fiber, and there are 60 grades of asbestos, and we've got some real good asbestos up there. But we started to drill, from the outcropping, we started to drill to see where this asbestos ended. We know there's a whole lens of asbestos out there. And every year we keep going out and out and out, and we still don't know where the edge of that is. And we know there's a tremendous asbestos field up there, one of the world regions for asbestos. They mined out the part of it, you know, there may be more. A lot of groundwork has been laid. I think you'll see much more activity, you know, and it's cost millions of dollars of outside companies that on all of our agreements, they have to give us the information. They like to keep the information secret, but they have to turn it over to us. We become the owners of the information. So we know better than the state and better than the federal government because they haven't had these drilling programs. We know where most of the minerals, we know where a lot of the minerals are. We have better data than state or federal government over a lot of land. State goes crazy, you know, because when we drop a selection, the state runs in there and they get second choice, so they pick it up. So they've been coming behind us and picking up what we leave behind.
Is there any problems between in the future between the villages and the corporation over the right to the land, subsurface and surface?
No. Because if you look at the makeup of the board of directors of the region, they're mostly village people. So the villages are controlling the politics of the region. And if there is a conflict, there are a lot of court cases upon that define what the subsurface rights are. The owner of the subsurface rights can go in and get what's there. So if there is a conflict, the regions are going to win. But nobody's going to get into that kind of a political fight. So what's going to happen is villages are going to hold the regions up for payment about what it amounts to. They're going to squeeze as much money out of there to go across the land as they can get. Yeah.
There was one thing you could change about the land claims act or how it's progressive.
That's a question.
Ask him if he could change anything about the act itself, land things, what would be, how would you change it, or how it's progressed. Well, I don't know. One of the dangers to the corporations is they're going to lose the land, and that may be in the long run the short sight the thing. When the land goes on sale in 1991, I think there's going to be a big rush for people to get control of that land. And maybe we need a little more protection in that area. I'll run through a scenario. You want just to illustrate what I mean. Louisiana Land is one of the smaller oil companies in America. Their income a couple years ago was $700 million. That's profits for in a quarter for some of the big oil companies, but they're not considered a big oil company. They went up on the Kandik and sunk $60 million in two dry holes just to look at two townships of land under a 10-year lease. Doyon has 9,000 shareholders. how much would you spend to get control of 12 million acres of land? If you spend $60 million to look at 50,000 acres of land, how much will you spend to own 12 million acres?
Whatever it
takes. Okay. I think they could get control of Doyon for $50 million.
Just buying out shares?
Just buying out shares. And I think that's the kind of thing. The people have already, with money, have already mapped out a strategy, I think. And when they do, they'll get control of that land and you will see some real development without concern for the local residents. Right now, the villagers control the politics of the board and they determine what the priorities are and where the drilling regions is. One of the regions, the first drilling took place out on the Canadian border, was there's nobody up there. Very few trap lines, no villages nearby. Nobody's lifestyle was upset. It would be a lot different. Jim is laughing because he probably knows a story that I don't know about somebody getting upset. But it'd be a lot different if they went into Fort Yukon, started flying Hercules in there night and day and bring in drilling rigs and drilling crews and started upsetting the village lifestyle. We'd get a scream. And the village, the politics would change right away. So that's one of the reasons they went way out. Now what happens is people like the work, and so they start saying, when's the next exploration program? I want to go out and build another airfield and some more roads and do some more drilling. So So then the politics shifts from getting it way out there where they have to do all that traveling to start getting the development closer to home. So I think we're going to start seeing pressure for jobs closer to home on developed land. So the pressure is going to come not for just mining and asbestos and, you know, other things, gold and uranium and whatever else might be out there. I don't know. I think it's the pressure for our resources is very great. World pressure for our resources is great. And so development is going to come. And I don't think it's, there's no use worrying about it, whether it's going to happen or whether we want it to happen or don't want it to happen, it's going to happen. About the only thing we can do is control a little bit about how it happens. And there's going to be, there is pressure right now for coal. They're shipping coal to Korea from Australia, and they're looking for Alaska coal, and there's demand for iron and copper and lead. And we have almost every known mineral here. And as the world needs it, they'll come and pay our price for it. So development will come, I think.
Is it true that land not conveyed by the BLM will not be subject to tax until 20 years after the date it has been conveyed?
Yeah, unless it's developed. If you went out there and you put a mine in, immediately it's taxable. Developed land is taxable right away. Undeveloped land is not. Jim?
A couple weeks ago, Don Wright was here, and he was really hot for transferring a lot of the corporation and the IRA for mandatory taxation. You keep them native.
Well, it has some advantages to get away from state taxes. Let me tell you a story about the guy who didn't pay taxes, though. Navy ships are required to dump their garbage at sea. The United States Navy ship pulled into Hong Kong Harbor, and they forgot to dump their garbage at sea, so this garbage bin was full. And the sandpan pulled up there, and he was a beggar, and he wanted garbage. So the guy on duty got permission from the officer to dump the garbage in this guy's sandpan. Well, he thought it was real funny. He maneuvered the guy right under the garbage chute. And when he had him there, he pulled the trap and he opened the door, and the garbage went all over this guy, all over his head and in his boat. He had about that much freeboard, and the boat was shaking, and he almost swamped him. And there was cans and orange peelings and coffee grinds and eggshells and bread. This guy dripping wet, and he picked up a piece of bread that had coffee grounds and everything on, and he popped it in his mouth and shook his head, nodded thank you, and he paddled away. Now there's a guy who didn't pay taxes. Taxing doesn't really bother me. If we're making money, we'll pay our taxes like everybody else. What concerns me more is what we've got to do, because we don't have a great deal of numbers of people in the state to control the politics. What worries me is a state taxing policy. Twice now. The only government entities that can tax in Alaska are city government and borough government. In most of Alaska, where native lands are, there is no taxing authority. There is no state doesn't levy property taxes. So twice, in the legislature, the Attorney General tried to pass a law that for statewide property taxes. The state of Alaska is, I think, positioning itself to tax native land. It's the only reason I could see for it. We were able to stop it. We may not be able to in the future. Now, that's the only advantage I can see for IRA. I'm not familiar with all the provisions of IRA, but there are some drawbacks to being an IRA, too. You tie yourself back into the government with some controls, and I don't know what they are, but So far, I think we just take our chances with.
Is there any truth to rumor you're working for big oil now?
I'm consulting and lobbying, yeah. With a good cause.
Maybe we can take about 5 or 10 minutes to break and then come back and you could find yourself a thing.
Seema? Go ahead, why don't you carry on? I'll write on the board while you're. Okay. Does anybody have anything further you want to ask him?
About what? Subsistence? No.
When you said we have the best data through the summer work.
Yes.
The oil companies, I assume, are somebody pays for the helicopters go in.
Right.
But who is the we?
Regional corporation. Because they own the data that the oil companies and mining companies collect.
On their land.
On their lands. And I don't know of a similar operation in state or federal. Except the federal government had, a program for uranium. They were looking for radioactive. But I don't think it ever got past the water stage. Just the water sampling.
Well, what are your good hopes? Sometimes it sounds like a self-destruct process for the future for these people. But what are your hopes? How can you
affect
the events?
A lot of people worried about the culture. And it's bothersome to a lot of people. The language is dead. And I think once we start worrying about the language, it's already gone. We're different than what our parents were, and our kids are going to be different than what we are. You know, culture is very dynamic. And we're not going to lock it in by anything we do. So being one of those things that I'm going to have very little impact on, I don't worry about it. And I don't think there's much anybody can do about it. You can control the direction development takes is about all. You can pick and choose. The land is broken up in such a way that reservations would be very hard, I suppose. You've got land around all the villages. You could have a bunch of little reservations. You have to go back to Congress to get it, though. And who knows what Congress is going to do. Once you open it up, they may decide, sure, we'll give you a reservation, but in exchange, you're going to have to give up half of your land. Once you open it up, the whole thing is open, I think. Once the political process gets going, we don't have any power to prevent them from doing anything they want to do.
Once they act, in order to become a reservation, you have to almost until they act or something like that?
No, once you get title to the land, you could go back and ask for protection of the government on it, federal government. And it might happen. If the state gets in a bind for taxes and starts to tax the regional corporations or just the raw land, for instance, Doyon, if the state decided they needed money and started to tax the land at 50 cents an acre, you're talking about $6 million in taxes every year. That's can't possibly make enough profit unless you have an oil well, excuse me, to pay taxes on that. And if the state started that, you'd have no recourse but to go back and ask for protection from Congress.
You think that would conceivably happen before the oil revenue began in the minute?
Not before then. After, when a state starts losing or can't meet their budgets, they'll go. In order of priority, I think the oil companies are number one for raising taxes. Regional corporations are number two. Number three would be the fishing. Number four would be tossed up between timber and mining. But I think they're looking very hard at regional corporations because we have coal and maybe some oil and other minerals. Yes.
How do you feel about the recession?
It's been tried before. No, the time for that would have been prior to statehood. The U.S. government didn't want Alaska. You know, it was always had this thing, Seward's Folly and Seward's Icebox, and they were tired of putting money up here to carry this territorial government. They really didn't want to give us statehood. And so I think at that point we could have very easily become a protectorate, just like the Philippines was a protector, you know, Cuba, a trust territory, or not a territory, but a protectorate with their own autonomy. And from there, it's an easy step to full sovereignty. Well, that's the problem. There was nobody here who thought it was a good idea. But they really didn't want us as a state.
After the Cold War,
Well, no. We've always been strategically located, and they've known that. But it's easy to pay lease for a military base or for a radar site or something like that. What made us too valuable was our resources. Once we hit oil, you know, they're not going to turn us loose. Out of every $20 coming out of Prudhoe now, is federal government gets $8. State of Alaska gets $7. And the oil companies get four. So the federal government has the bulk of the money and cash coming off of the North Slope. So they're not going to give that up.
Is there any way that you can get the federal government to get less money out of that?
Reduce the price of oil. Is one group?
Yeah.
We'd own almost half of Alaska if we did that.
Uh-huh.
Problem with throwing in the state, I don't think we could, but if they did, we wouldn't get any benefits from it except through taxes. We just have to share. I don't see any practical way of doing it. The IRA is one way. Reservation is another.
Thank you.
No, I don't. It's a cause for concern. And we have some of the highest suicide rates anywhere. I know the federal government has sent in teams of psychiatrists to try to determine what the problems are, but nothing happens. And that's subject for a whole lecture by itself, I'm sure, by someone much more informed than I am. I don't know what can be done. But one other question, ma'am.
Maybe I'm not reading you correctly, and with that prelude, let me ask you. It seems to me that the picture you're painting is a very pessimistic one. Village life is going to die out. Development is going to come in and maybe or maybe not be controlled. Perhaps corporations are going to lose their land. Is there no hope in the picture anymore?
Hope is for the individual.
To do what? To get rich?
No. To fan so that you get away from the suicide things and to be feel good with themselves and to be able to function without Bureau of Indian Affairs for one. To have some wealth, sure. There's one of the things I don't want to see is people to grow up poor and have a wealthy state, industrial state, grow up around them. That wouldn't be right. So, wealth would be part of it.
But you can have wealth and be poor in spirit.
Sure can. I've been accused of having a kind of a Cassandra view of things anyway, of being downbeat. And sometimes I purposely take that role. I think there are some bright spots, but people have to prepare for them. It's not going to just happen.
When you say you're a consultant for oil for a good cause, I think I know what you mean by that.
The oil companies are taxed under a whole separate law. Every corporation, well, banks come under a separate law, but every other corporation comes under a chapter of law for taxing. Oil companies are segregated out. They pay a very heavy tax burden. Now, when I said what I meant by good cause is, every village and regional corporation is now, by definition, an oil company. So they're going to carry a very heavy tax burden, more so than the hotel corporations and the construction companies that are not owned by regional corporations. If they're owned by a regional corporation, whether it's a hotel or an office building or construction company, that income is taxed as oil income. The regional corporations and everything they own are taxed as oil companies. And that's what I mean by good cause. That I am working for ARCO. I'm not working for them. I work for myself and I sell them about 2 days a week of my time. Under Alaska statutes 43.21.010, definition is that any corporation doing business in Alaska that derives income from oil and gas production or transportation is subject to that chapter, that is taxing under that chapter. 0.020 defines what production is, 030 tells what transportation is, 040 is all other income. So anything the corporations own is taxed under that chapter. And what it means is there's no, if you're accounting, there's no accelerated depreciation, there are no investment tax credits, there are no loss carry forwards, and a lot of the corporations have had multi-million dollars in losses under normal taxing procedure, you can go back 5 years and carry your losses into this tax year and avoid paying taxes. Perfectly legal. That's the way the law is written. I'm sure it wasn't intended. I'll give them the benefit of the doubt, it wasn't intended. But Cook Inlet region got $70,000 off Swanson River last year. They're going to get about $6 million next year. Under Section 7I, they share 70% of that income with all the other regions. Under Section 7J, the regions in turn share 50% with all of the villages.
That's all the litigation.
What is?
Isn't it
7J? Well, not the resource. It's revenue from earnings from construction companies and hotels and whatnot. Whether that's shareable with the villages, I think, is the question in the litigation. Not the pass through from resources. I might be wrong, but.
But in reality, that section of the statute hasn't been effective, hasn't it? Is that just somebody's interpretation at this point? I mean, so it's not certain yet as to whether or not it's applicable.
According to the guy who read the state regulations, he said it was very plain that the pass-through will affect the villages. it's a legal opinion, of course.
In reality, though, at least four of the regions are not welcome, or not now, but will be because of that.
What are some of the possible hopes of eliminating the oil corporation status?
Well, how you tax them, I mean, what rate you tax them on, and what chapter you tax them under, I think are two separate questions. And one of the concerns about abolishing Chapter 21, which is what I'm lobbying for, is they say we're going to lose state revenue. That's a whole separate question. The whole Chapter 21 is going to go to the Supreme Court anyway. It's in the courts. It's not expected to reach the Supreme Court until 1985. If the state of Alaska loses, they just appropriated $13 million to fight the case. That'll go, $13 million until 1985, and if they lose the case, the liability is going to be between $7 and $8 billion if the courts tell them, the state, to return the money that they collected, which, if they win, would be illegal collection of taxes. So I think what they ought to do is just abolish Chapter 21, tax them under Chapter 20, which is legal, and then how much money you get out of them is subject to, you fiddle with percentages then to get what money you need. You know, I was trying to remember how 7I came about. We looked at the United States and we saw some pretty wealthy Indian tribes and some pretty poor ones. And we said, if there's any wealth in the land, there's no use having a very wealthy group of people and some really poor groups. And so it was kind of a sharing idea that there would be no poor Alaska Native groups. 7J, I'm not sure how that got in there. I'm at large, so I'm against it. No, I'm not. It makes it tough for a region to be profitable once you start sharing that. When it gets to minerals, that 70% sharing may just kill a mineral prospect, because minerals is not oil. There's just not the profit in hard rock mining that there is in oil.
Working on it now, but it just seems awfully
No, it's clear. The region owns it, and if they want it, they'll develop it. And they will. If they need the money, they'll develop it. There might be a fight about how much they pay a village to go across their land, but that's about all. They have a right to go get it. And I don't think there's much chance of getting it out of the act. There's going to be an effort to change it, I mean, to modify it, but not to get it out.
No, I meant to modify
it. Oh, yeah. There's a big meeting this week, as a matter of fact, to arrive at a position. You going? You're going to that.
What do you foresee after the oil is gone? What do you think?
Well, I don't know. I can't see that far in the future. You know, I don't think we're going to run out of oil in Alaska for a long time, and by then we'll go through a stage like every other developing country, and someday we'll be like New York, an old decaying society. But you know, I don't know how it's. We'll develop just like the West did. A lot of wealth and a lot of movement around, a lot of building, and then we'll stabilize at some point and start to decay after we stabilize.
What do you think of agriculture?
I think we have so much agricultural potential in interior Alaska. The problem is transportation. There has been transportation. There's an experiment up here in Beaver. Anybody from Beaver? They got the idea that they wanted to grow potatoes to sell along the Yukon. So they ordered a backhoe and front-end loader, and they got a train load of seed potatoes. They dumped them up there from a barge. They had a mountain of these little seed potatoes from the Matanuska Valley, and they brought in the loader, and they cleared the land, and that's as far as it went. Once they didn't do the study on it before they did it. What happens with potatoes, you go out there and you plant them and you pull them up in September. In September, no more boats are running. So then you have to start flying them out in the little airport, so you had to fly them out in 180. By the time you paid the air freight on them, it was cheaper to get Idaho potatoes by river in the summertime than it was to get fly them out. And they could supply enough potatoes from that one little village for the whole Yukon Valley, for the villages. So it's a matter of economics. And there again, you get the people. If you had a lot of people, you could sell everything you could produce. But there's no market. With air transportation, there's no market, because the product is priced higher than you can bring it in by water. The cheapest form of transportation is water. And that would be true with carrots and, you know, lettuce and everything else. So, but there's a great potential for agriculture. They've got this big experiment down here in Delta, barley. And what the state wants to subsidize freight rates to the equivalent of Portland, Oregon, or some crazy thing down there, so that we can compete with the Far Eastern market. If Japan wanted our wheat, they'd pay the same price to land it in Tokyo as they would Oregon wheat or Idaho wheat. And without state subsidy, we couldn't compete. because of transportation. Cost of getting it out of here is just too high. It gets down to a loaf of bread, you know, they're not going to buy Alaska bread if it costs twice as they can buy it from somebody else's wheat.
Well, is it China that's closer than Oregon, Alaska?
I don't know the economics, but I don't think they grow as much wheat. They don't have access to export.
They don't have a port or a factory?
They don't have excess product. United States, if you take economic geography, you'll see the accidents of nature, why we have so much product that we can ship worldwide, because we're fortunate in being in the temperature zones with the right kind of rainfall to grow more food than we eat. China is not in that position because their weather runs north and south. Ours runs east and west, and we have these belts of production they don't have, and they just don't produce enough to feed their own people. So they don't export. We do.
Bob Dietrich, a veterinarian here at the university, who's been involved in the reindeer studies, said that there have been some studies done recently with feeding reindeer the Far Lakes Delta, that the reindeer seem to thrive on it. In fact, they come together with some of the biggest reindeer come out of that experiment. Has anybody studied the economic feasibility of reindeer herding with Delta?
No, I don't know about that, but there's a guy who can tell you about reindeer. The problem with reindeer is there's such a big market that the Japanese will come in here and they'll take every reindeer in 1 year if you let them. But they can't take any reindeer until you get a USDA stamp on it. And to get a USDA stamp, you need stainless steel slaughterhouses and, you know, all kinds of investments that people just don't have to put into the slaughter. And once you put in that heavy investment, you don't have enough reindeer to fill up a ship to, you know, to keep a sustained yield. So they got to build the herds up to get more of a herd to slaughter before they can start exporting. In an oversimplified nutshell, I think that's the situation. Yes.
What do you think about the Johnson mapping program?
I'm not familiar with it enough to. I know it exists and. Willie? You said 5:35. Okay. I just missed the plane, so.
Good, you have to come to our reception anyway. Is there another one of these somewhere?
Yeah. I want to see who all showed up. I haven't been past the sound set.
See, everybody signed. No? I guess this is a complete list. Goodness. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19. There's got to be more than 19. Oh, okay. Okay.
How many started back telling you?
Well, I think there was around 40 or 41 that started. I don't know. How many is left? 25 or 30? Whoever takes the final, I guess, is the final holdouts, huh? These are some of the questions I thought you ought to